All right, pay attention to me. Quiet. We want to finish this integumentary system chapter. We got up to hair, slide 6. And hair is a feature of all mammals, at least to some extent. It might seem that we're not very hairy mammals compared to other things, but really we are, in a sense, just as hairy. The difference is that a lot of our hair is not pigmented, and it's not as long in certain places as it is in other mammals, but we have a lot of hairs on our general surface. They're just not all very dark hairs, which is what really is conspicuous. But hairs are accessory structures, along with nails and glands of various sorts, like we've talked about already. And a hair grows out of the skin from within the dermis, but there is an invagination of the epidermis, an in-pocketing that actually goes down into the thickness of the dermis and forms part of what we call the follicle. So there is a hair follicle that forms basically a tube through which the hair itself grows. And that hair follicle has as layers two root sheaths, a connective tissue root sheath, as you see on the upper right, and an epithelial root sheath. So the epithelial root sheath, of course, is epithelial cells, and so is the epidermis. So really, that epithelial root sheath is just continuous with the epidermal cells. They take a turn down into the thickness of the dermis and form part of that follicle. The hair itself consists of a hair bulb, which is the bulbous part, the enlarged deep end. That then gives rise to the hair root, which is the basically where the bulbousness ends and it starts becoming the same diameter, but it's still in the dermis. That's the root. It's root all the way up until the surface of the epidermis. So once it's finally free of the actual surface that you see, then that is the shaft itself. Okay, the hair shaft as labeled on the upper left. So it's not that it's different stuff. It's just that the hair shaft is older cells. Those cells were created longer ago, and they used to be part of the root, and before that, they were part of the bulb. And in the process of making a hair, it's much like the process of making skin cells. They're all produced at the same place as brand new cells, and then they develop and harden and die in that process. So the only ones that are alive, really, are in the bulb. By the time hair cells have been pushed upward because of the addition of new cells at the bulb, those hair cells that were in the bulb have now died and hardened. And therefore, the root and the shaft combined is just a rod of dead cells. Dead, hard cells. And what makes them hard?
Keratin.
What kind of keratin? There's keratin in the skin as well, remember. No one remembers those technical terms? Hard keratin and soft keratin. It's soft keratin in the skin, in the nails and the hair. It's called hard keratin because the molecules of keratin are cross-linked with each other, so it makes it a big, complex, tough structure. Now, the an individual hair itself, if you were to take a cross section of it, a transverse section of it, and look at it on end, it would appear like concentric circles. The deepest part of that is the medulla. Now, medulla is a general term that refers to the comparatively deeper part of something. And the comparatively superficial part of something that has a layered appearance or a layered structure is called the cortex. For instance, these same words are applied to a kidney. There is the renal medulla, that's deeper inside, and there's the renal cortex that surrounds that renal medulla. Same thing with the hair. The medulla is the deepest part, and then there's a cortex surrounding that. So in cross-section, it would look like a circle around the dot in the middle. That would be the cortex. And then most superficial on the hair itself is a layer of cells called the cuticle. And the cuticle are made of flattened cells. The cuticle is made of flattened cells that overlap each other, kind of like shingles on a roof, which you wouldn't see unless, of course, you looked at it microscopically. Notice that at the bulb, there is a dermal papilla. And we've already talked about these in reference to the dermis's relationship to the epidermis. This dermal papilla is really no different other than it's associated with a hair, and it's deeper in the dermis than the other ones, because most of the dermal papillae are up right at the interface between dermis and epidermis, right? You have those dermal papillae there. A dermal papilla for a hair is deeper down in the dermis because that's where the bulb is. But it's still just like the others because you have epidermis coming down into the dermis to form that epithelial root sheath. The dermal papilla of a hair is there for the same reason that it is for any other dermal papilla, which is to bring a blood supply to the hair bulb, which makes sense because that's where the living cells are, right? They need nourishment and they need somewhere to dump waste. So that's where the actively dividing or mitotically active cells in a hair is. Specifically, that region of cells that are mitotically active, which means they're continuously dividing, producing new cells, is called the hair matrix. The hair matrix is really part of the bulb. Okay, so that's where the new hair cells are created by mitosis. When you look on the left, which is the cartoon version, but it gives more detail actually, you can see that a hair is somewhat diagonally arranged with respect to the skin. It's tilted a little bit. But that can change because associated with the follicle is the tube that holds the hair itself, remember, is a smooth muscle called a piloerector muscle, as you see labeled there. Now, pilus, P-I-L-U-S, means hair. And this is why something that is a chemical designed to remove hair is called what? Nair, for instance, is an example of what? It's called a depilatory because it takes away hair, depilatory. I'm more of a neat man myself. But anyway, that's same root. A piloerector muscle in some books will be called erector pili. That's A-R-R-E-C-T-O-R, P-I-L-I, two words. It's the same thing, though. You can use the phrase piloerector muscle or erector pili. Both refers to the smooth muscle that's attached at the follicle. And therefore can contract. I mean, any muscle, that's the only thing muscles do on their own is contract. When a piloerector muscle contracts, it does what its name implies. It erects the pilus. It straightens out the hair. And so we can call that process piloerection. Now, there's another word that applies to the same thing, actually, which is horripilation. Horripilation. Horripilation gets its name because it is the standing of hair on its end in response to horror or being afraid. You see this, or threatened. You see this happening in dogs, for instance. Dogs get threatened or scared, they will horripilate. There'll be a ridge of erect hair all along their back, which happens because if they have long hair, piloerection will make them look a little bigger and therefore a little bit more threatening to whatever is endangering them. So basically it's a way for them to avoid a fight, hopefully, which could damage them. Hopefully the thing will be scared away. But the same thing happens to us, right? It also happens to my Great Dane, which is kind of funny because, first of all, she's pretty big anyway, and they have such short hair that it doesn't make much of a difference when they undergo horripilation. But we also feel it too, you know, or when we say we get goosebumps, it's the same thing that's happening. These piloerector muscles are erecting our hairs. Now, erection of hair also can have a different function, though. Because the shaft of the hairs, which are the part that are superficial to the skin surface, the combination of all these shafts nearby each other makes it kind of traps air in there. Just like it would be more windy in an open field compared to of the same field planted with a bunch of trees, right? So it traps an airspace, and if that air gets trapped in there by the hairs, then that is a boundary layer for the loss or gain of heat. So it's the air itself is an insulation layer, as long as it doesn't get too disturbed. And by changing the angle that the hairs make with respect to the skin, the animal can change the thickness of that trapped air, that boundary layer. So it's actually another way of exercising thermostasis, which is a major function of the integumentary system. Associated with the follicle is also, notice, an apocrine sweat gland. And we've talked about these before. Remember, those are the ones that don't occur just everywhere on the skin. Those are the ones that are not for the purpose of evaporative cooling, but for the release of pheromones, for instance. They're the ones that produce the secretion rich in lipids that by itself is odorless, but becomes what we sense as body odor once bacteria living on the body start breaking down those lipids. So it would have, you know, this cartoon is taken from, for instance, an axilla, an armpit, which is where you find these things. You don't find them just everywhere. But remember that I said another distinction besides what they secrete between an apocrine and an miocrine sweat gland is that the apocrine sweat glands have their ducts lead to the hair itself rather than all the way to the skin surface. So the skin gets oiled, the hair gets oiled by this oily substance that the apocrine sweat glands produce, and then by growing, they drag that out. What have we not talked about here? I don't think anything. So let's go on. Before I get to actually what's on slide 7, let me say that there in humans, there are three distinct types of hair. And I'm not talking about from person to person. There's all kinds of different hair colors. I'm talking about three different types of hair in an individual. The first of those is lanugo. L-A-N-U-G-O. And this is fetal hair. And so you're really unlikely to see lanugo unless you look at a premature baby. Because usually by the time of birth, parturition, the lanugo has been replaced by the second type of hair. Lanugo can be fairly long, but it's very fine and it is unpigmented. And so that really is pre-birth hair. Next to develop is vellus hair, V-E-L-L-U-S, which is also very fine and often unpigmented, although it can be slightly pigmented. And this starts growing after the vellus hair is lost, I mean after the lanugo is lost, and continues to grow throughout life. And in terms of number, is probably the most numerous type of hair on your body. Because it's unpigmented, that's why it seems like we don't have nearly as much hair as something that we, like a bear, right? But if all those vellus hairs were dark, like the third type of hair, we would look furry because those hairs are there. So when we talk about peach fuzz, for instance, that's vellus hair. And if you look closely at your arm, you'll see the same thing. The third type is terminal hair. And terminal hair also grows on most parts of the skin, although mostly on the scalp. So when we really talk about hair cosmetically, we're talking about the terminal hair of the scalp. But it's also, terminal hair makes up the eyebrows and the eyelashes, pubic hair, axillary hair, all the dark stuff, basically, for people who have darkly pigmented terminal hair. Not everyone does. And so it is much coarser as well. This is another thing that makes other mammals seem like they have a lot more hair, is that their individual hairs are a lot wider in diameter. So just the coarseness makes them look like they have more individual hairs. Terminal hair grows soon after birth in certain parts of the body, depending on the individual. For instance, you have some newborns with scalp hair, eyebrows, eyelashes, things like that. But a lot of the terminal hair waits until puberty to come in, like axillary hair and pubic hair, for instance. And now we can get to slide 7's information to see that a hair undergoes three major stages numbered here. Notice that those stages in order are called anagen, catagen, and telogen. But anagen here is broken down into early and late, or early and mature here. Anagen overall refers to the so-called growing phase. And for a terminal hair, this growing phase, notice, on average is 6 to 8 years. Assuming nothing has damaged that hair, or nothing has come along to pull it out, it will continue to grow slowly and gradually, but actually the speed at which it grows drastically depends on the individual, right? Some people grow hair quickly, some not so quickly, but whatever rate you are stuck with genetically, it'll grow on average for 6 to 8 years. That is anagen. And so what I said before is happening during that time. In the matrix, there is mitosis going on, which is creating more and more cells, which are pushing all the cells above it toward the skin surface. That's how the hair elongates. But as soon as those cells are out of the bulb, they die and harden with their hard keratin and become part of what will first be the root and then the shaft. During this anagen time, for an early follicle, notice that the follicle grows deeper into the depth of the dermis. So in the mature version, that bulb is deeper below the epidermis because the follicle itself has grown downward. After anagen is catagen, which is just a weeks-long period, and growth has stopped here, this is the degenerative phase. And notice that the hair loses its association with the papilla. So the lower follicle, which was making up basically the bulb, that is what is degenerating. You can see that right above the dermal papilla. What used to be an active bulb is now degenerating. And so the hair at this point is called a club hair because it's entirely dead. It's no longer, it doesn't have a living end to it anymore. And it will, depending on what happens to it, it might remain there for a while. You know, if something comes along and brushes on it, it can easily fall out. And that's because it's lost its relationship to the underlying structures. But it could also just stay there for a while and actually not come out until it's pushed out by a new hair in the next phase of anagen. Which is why I think they have an old club hair. Yeah, an old club hair is being pushed out. So the third is telogen. That's the resting phase. Really just waiting for another hair to start. So there's no more degeneration that takes place. It's just a hair in resting phase. And like I said, it's more precarious, can fall out more easily during that time. But in a healthy individual, you know, it'll take a little bit of tugging to get it out, so it usually does stay there for a while. All right, so this isn't synchronized. Not all of your hairs start at anagen at the same time. Otherwise, you would have scalp hair for a number of years, and then you'd be totally bald for a couple of weeks, and then you would start over. Instead, every hair is independent in terms of what stage it's in. So we always have a certain fraction of the hairs in anagen, certain fraction in catagen and telogen. And since anagen is so much longer than the other two stages in duration, that means that it looks like we have a lot of hairs growing. But if you got in there and actually paid attention and made measurements, a lot of those hairs will not be growing. They're just sticking around. They're in the resting phase. Only the telogen ones are actually growing. By the way, notice this hair is, all the hair that you can touch, which is outside of the skin, is completely dead. Which is why trimming it does not cause it to grow or slow down in growth. But there's no signal sent through dead cells telling the body that it has been cut. So if you think, well, I know definitely that it can get longer if I trim it every now and then. What's really happening there is when you trim hairs, you're making nice clean cuts. You're getting rid of split ends. Split ends, if not cut, can start continuing to split farther and farther toward the skin. So it can make it easier for that hair to break off and make it even shorter. You see what I'm saying? But if you didn't have any split ends and you never trimmed it, that would be the maximum length you could get. And for each human, it's only going to get to a certain length. Like mine grew to about right here and didn't stop. It was here for years. But then you have Crystal Gale. Does she still have long hair? It was like down to the floor. It just depends on the human. Okay, let's go to nails in slide 8. Nails are also very tough, of course, and that's also because of hard keratin, and they're even tougher than hair, but not because of a third type of keratin. Rather, it's just they have a lot more of the keratin. There's a lot of cells in the thickness of a nail, much thicker than a hair shaft. And of course, they occur not just on the fingers, but on the toes as well. We're looking at a finger here, though. So let's just look at these basic anatomy terms here. The nail itself is curved, of course. Well, in a healthy person, it's curved. It can be curved the other way for various reasons. But you don't see the entire nail when you look at an intact finger. The curvature actually continues beyond the edges that you see, and it becomes even more pronounced, the curvature. Each side curves down into basically a furrow or a little groove called the nail groove that it glides along basically as more cells are added. So the production of a nail is very similar to the production of hair cells in that there is a population of cells making up a matrix, just like there was for hair. The nail matrix is where the living cells are. Just like a hair, the vast majority of a nail is made up of dead cells. And the matrix, notice, is proximal to the visible part of the nail. So it's embedded in the skin before the nail actually emerges. Now you do, in most people, have a lunule, a little white region. What does lunule mean? Well, that makes sense because it is, but it doesn't make sense linguistically. What does luna mean? Moon. So lunule, the yol thing is a diminutive suffix, means a little. So it's a little moon. It's a little crescent, basically, shaped, which is why it's called that. But the matrix is actually even more proximal to the lunule, as you see labeled right there. That's where the new material is added. That's the mitotically active part of the nail bed. The nail fold is the skin that overlies the matrix. And as cells are added at the matrix, they harden and die, just like in a hair. And since there's always new nail cells being added at the matrix, the nail continuously grows. And it only grows during life. It's another myth about skin's accessory structures. Your nails don't continue growing after you die. It seems like that because if you look at a cadaver, the loss of fluids causes shrinkage of the fingers. The nails stay the same length, but the fingers, the skin of the fingers shrink, so it makes it look like the nails have grown more. Now, I shouldn't say that as soon as you are pronounced dead, there can be no growth, because your entire body does not die at once, right? You officially die when your brain dies, but you still have living cells that are metabolizing for a little bit, not for very long. What were you going to say?
Just out of curiosity, what about the hair after a person passes?
Same thing. Same thing. It's just the skin shrinks away, and it might look like it's going to grow for a while, but it's not actually getting longer. You're seeing just more of it. So the nail bed is the skin directly beneath the nail itself. And as the nail grows, it skids along that nail bed. And the nail bed is really not part of the nail, of course, but it's directly associated with it. Now, notice the word eponychium, which is the cuticle, that little flap right at the proximal part of the nail. Cuticle is probably what you've been calling it your whole life, but its official name is eponychium. There's also a corresponding word, hyponychium. It's not actually listed here, I guess. The hyponychium is the little fold of skin just where the overhang of the nail is. And that little overhang, as you see, is called the free edge. So the free edge is what you cut if you're a person who cuts its nails. Some people allow them to grow. Some people bite them continuously, but that's the free edge. And it looks lighter, not because the cells are different, because they're just older cells. They've been around longer. It looks lighter because you're no longer seeing any blood through it like you do for the rest of the nail. The pinkishness of a nail is because you're seeing through the nail cells and seeing some of the blood in the skin beneath it in the nail bed. If we had black nails, like some dogs, we wouldn't see any difference all the way to the tip, right? When you look at the claw of a dog, if it's a white claw, you can see where the quick ends, right? You can see that blood in it, which makes it more convenient to cut them because you don't want to cut into the quick. But if you cut the black nail of a dog, you kind of have to guess. Sometimes you can get it to bleed. All right, so that's the basic anatomy of a nail. Now let's go to glands in slide 9. We've already talked a little bit about glands. So we have a mirocrine gland on the right and apocrine gland on the left. Those are both sweat glands, but just keep in mind that apocrine sweat is not about cooling you. Apocrine sweat is about releasing pheromones and scent to other individuals. Mirocrine glands are much more numerous. So they appear basically all over the skin, and they're especially concentrated in the palms and in the soles, so your hands and your feet sweat a little bit more than the rest of your body for most people. By the way, it's possible for a female to have patchiness with respect to sweating. The way the genetics works is that if a female is heterozygous for the allele, and it doesn't matter if you don't know what I'm talking about genetically, then there will be parts of her body that have active sweat glands and parts that don't. It'll just be a mosaic. You can't tell by looking at her, but little patches of skin will sweat and other patches nearby will not. It was determined when she was an embryo developing which regions will have sweat glands and which won't. But for all males and all the rest of the females, sweat glands are pretty well distributed over the entire skin with a higher concentration in the palms and the soles. Sebaceous glands are so called, and you see that on C here, sebaceous glands are called this because the secretory product is called sebum. Sebum is body oil. So when we talk about oily skin, for instance, that oil itself is called sebum, and the glands that produce it are called sebaceous glands. And so sebaceous glands also have their ducts associated with a hair follicle, and that's all over the body. Well, at least the parts of the body that are hairy. The palms and the soles are also hairless. In addition to being more sweaty, you don't have hair on them. But in most parts of the skin, you have hair. And so associated with these hairs are sebaceous glands that produce oil into the follicle as the hair grows. Just like the apocrine sweat glands I was talking about, except that those apocrine sweat glands are not all over the body. Those are just at the hairs in the axilla and the groin region. All right, let's, well, actually before, Yeah, let me talk a little bit more about apocrine sweat, or miracrine sweat glands. Miracrine sweat glands, as I've said several times, are the ones that produce what we normally think of as sweat. This is a watery substance, but it's not pure water. There are salts, and actually quite a few other chemicals in sweat. And really, the sweat glands, even though each individual sweat gland doesn't do much in terms of this function, what I'm talking about, there's a lot of sweat glands. So collectively, the sweat glands function for removal of waste. So there's a function of excretion that you can add to the list of functions for the integumentary system. I don't know whether I mentioned that when we were talking about the basic functions last time or not. But the major organs of excretion, when we think of excretion, are the kidneys, right? The kidneys rid the body of nitrogenous and other wastes. Well, the sweat glands help out as well. And really for the same reason. You know, when you produce urine, where does that urine come from? What is urine? It's just filtered blood, exactly. So blood is urine with other stuff in it. After it passes through the kidney and gets filtered, the good stuff is kept in the blood and everything else becomes urine. Similarly, at an apocrine sweat gland, the capillary that's right at that, that surrounds the cells of that gland, will squeeze out certain materials, just like get squeezed out at the glomeruli, which are the little parts of the functional parts of the kidney. And therefore, mixed in with that water that sweat is mostly made of are other things, some of which are waste products, like urea. Urea is a component of urine, but it's also a component of sweat. So we get rid of some urea, which is nitrogenous waste, via our sweat glands. But the major reason we need the sweat glands, because the kidneys can handle the waste aspect, the major reason we need them is for thermal regulation or thermostasis. Now, so I want to explain why sweat works so well. I've already talked about two major modes of heat transfer. What were those that we discussed? Conduction and convection, correct. Evaporation is another major mode of heat transfer. But whereas the other modes, conduction and convection, could be either a gain of heat or a loss of heat, depending on the situation, right? If you touch something hot, you're going to conductively gain heat. If you touch something cold, you're going to conductively lose heat. Similarly, convection. You know, when it's 110 degrees Fahrenheit outside, you don't want it to be windy because that wind, which is convection, is actually going to heat you up because it's hotter than you are. On a cool day, though, the wind will make you even cooler. So you can go in either direction depending on the direction of the gradient. Evaporation, though, always will lose heat from the surface from which evaporation is occurring. And what is evaporation? Chemically speaking, what is happening? What is it? Yes, it's a state change, though, right? It's a change of state of matter. In other words, it's a change from liquid to vapor. That's why it's called evaporation. It turns liquid into vapor. Now, liquid molecules are not any different from vapor molecules, so that's not a chemical change. That's a physical change. What is it that distinguishes a liquid from a gas? They're both fluids, but there's a distinction. What is really the difference between liquid and gas? It's the closeness together of those particles, right? They're packed way more closely together in a liquid state than they are in gas state. So to understand, evaporation sheds heat from the body simply because you are shedding matter from the body. Right? When you evaporate the water in the sweat, you're losing that water, which is why it can dehydrate you if you let it go without supplementing now and then by drinking. So you're losing matter, and matter carries heat, right? Like I was talking about before. That's why blood carries heat, because it is made up of matter. So you lose some heat just for that reason. You're losing matter. But there's a more important reason why it's so successful in cooling your body. And you have to understand the difference between heat and temperature. And I think I already talked about this a little bit, right? Heat is what kind of property? Intensive or extensive? Only two choices. Take a stab. And why is it extensive? It is extensive, but what does that mean? Extensive means that the extent you have matters. How much matter you have matters. All right, this is where I said, I think I used the swimming pool analogy, right? Swimming pool has a hell of a lot more water molecules in it than a cup of water you sample from that pool. So it's a much greater extent, and therefore has a lot more heat, because heat is just the thermal energy, the energy of motion of those particles. More molecules, more motion. Temperature, on the other hand, is an intensive property. And there the intensity matters, not how much stuff you have. And so even though there's a lot less heat in the little cup of water you take from the pool, at least after you take it, they're exactly at the same temperature. They have the same temperature. And temperature, the reason that the extent does not matter in temperature is because you divide out the mass. It's the average speed of those particles. When you compute an average, right, you add all the speeds together, but then you divide by the number of particles. So that's why the number of particles doesn't matter. You divide by it. So temperature just gives you an idea of the average speed of particles, but no particles, I mean, the particles are not moving at that average speed. They're all moving independently. Some of them are way above average, some of them are below average. Some of them might be right at average. All right, that's the temperature itself. And when heat moves by conduction, for instance, it's the temperature gradient, not the heat gradient, that matters. Right? So heat is going to move from where it's a higher temperature to a lower temperature by conduction. But for evaporation, there is a state change. And water has all kinds of very important properties that make it not unique, but special compared to most chemicals. And most of those properties are so important that we wouldn't exist without them. For instance, the polarity of water gives it all kinds of different properties. One special property of water is that it has, compared to most chemicals, a pretty high latent heat of vaporization. Now, any given substance has a latent heat of vaporization. That's just a measurement. But what the latent heat of vaporization is how much heat, how much energy is required to evaporate or turn from liquid to a gas a gram of that stuff. And since water has a higher latent heat of vaporization than most other chemicals, it means it really takes a lot of energy to evaporate water compared to other things. And therefore, a lot of energy is lost from the liquid portion as it evaporates. But why on a molecular level is it actually losing heat? Well, if you imagine just a container of liquid water, You have to imagine all the tiny little water molecules, and they're all moving in their own directions and speeds. But there is an average speed, and that's what the temperature is, basically. All right. Above that liquid surface is air. And if water is going to evaporate, what that means is that a particle of water that's a member of this tightly packed liquid population needs to escape that surface and go off on its own in the gas. Now, the reason that's hard to do is because, for water compared to others, is because of water's polarity. Water's a polar molecule, and therefore water molecules stick to each other. They line up so that the partially negative part of the water is stuck a little bit by a hydrogen bond to the partially positive part of the next water molecule. Unlike nonpolar molecules, like oxygen molecules, don't care what each other's doing. They're just bumping against each other. They're not held together. So for any given water molecule to escape the surface and go off as gas, it's going to be more difficult than it would be for other substances. All right? But if any particle is going to do it, which particles have the best chance? Well, first of all, you have to be near the surface, right? Because otherwise, there's just a bunch of other water molecules in the way. But if we just restrict our attention to the ones at the surface, which water molecules are most likely to escape the surface? The ones that are fastest, exactly. Their energy of motion is sufficient to overcome those hydrogen bonds that are trying to hold them against the other water molecules. So the fastest of the population of water molecules in the liquid phase are the ones that are actually going to leave the liquid phase and become gas molecules. What does that do to the temperature? It lowers it, because when you compute the new average after you've removed the fastest ones from the population, the average speed is going to go down, right? You've gotten rid of the fastest members. So this is why it cools the liquid. You can easily demonstrate this to yourself by taking a cloth, run as hot, water as hot as you can stand to touch it onto it, wring it out, you have a hot rag, basically. And if you just spread that out and flap it in the air a few times, it will not only no longer be hot, you can get it to be very cold. And that's because you're getting rid of all those fastest molecules. Those are leaving into the gas phase. And the liquid ones left behind are now have a much lower average speed, and therefore a lower temperature.
What happens exactly in exhaustion? As tough as you may seem, you wouldn't know right now, but I used to work out.
Yeah.
I'd climb mountains all over the place. Okay. There would be times that I'd know to come in, but just before I'd come in, out of the heat or whatever, my body, you could just feel it was unusually just soaking wet.
Yeah, the problem with heat exhaustion is that you've stressed the homeostasis, the homeostatic elements in your body, the things trying to keep the body temperature within the allowable limit. You've stressed them to their limit, and basically the body gets confused. And it starts to wildly fluctuate. It can go way above or way below body temperature and can't control itself anymore. It can't react in time to keep it in that narrow range. And if you get locked outside of that allowable range, that's when you can die.
Two things I've heard working in the construction industry and whatever. Number one, your body can secrete up to 1 gallon of fluid per hour.
Doesn't seem like it with sweating, because especially if the sweat is doing its job and evaporating. That's what I was talking about by not noticing you're sweating when you're biking. When the air movement is enough to take those gas molecules away from you, you don't feel wet at all. And that's because you're just you're not keeping that liquid on your surface. It's evaporating into air, which is what's keeping you cool. And that's why, even though it doesn't seem like you've sweated. You need to replenish that liquid by drinking.
The other thing is, I hear a big thing about electric bikes. You sweat real heavy, your electric bike chemicals, is that true?
Yeah, because of what I was talking about for waste removal at sweat glands. So that's, there's a lot of salts that get left behind, because just like if you boil salt water on a stove and forget you're doing that, come back 3 hours later, you'll have a dry pan with salt on the bottom, right? Because the salt did not reach its boiling temperature. So the water evaporated and left the salt solids behind. This actually happens on your skin, and I should have mentioned this earlier. I don't think I did.
But it's not just salt.
Right. It's all kinds of salts. Yeah, not just table salt, all kinds of salts. And yeah, those electrolytes need to be replenished as well. But this is another function, though, of sweat. It contributes to what is called the acid mantle of the skin, which is a, as the name implies, a slightly acidic layer of deposits that we put onto our skin. And this is part of that protection function of the integumentary system. So certain things can't live there that could do us harm because of the pH. Now there's plenty of things that do live on you. Like I said, you're vastly outnumbered by bacteria compared to your own cells. But most of those bacteria are not only not harmful, they're actually beneficial. Still, the acid mantle is part of our defense, and that's added to, that's replenished by the sweat and the things that get left behind as the water from sweat evaporates. Mm-hmm. Okay, I think that does it for that slide. 10, as you see, is just a table for study, but one thing I don't think I mentioned is that the mirocrine and apocrine sweat glands, which I've already talked about the distinction a lot of times, they both, as you see, are classified as sudoriferous glands. So sudoriferous glands really means generally sweat glands, and then which type of sweat you're talking about depends on which type of sudoriferous gland is producing the product. Sebaceous glands produce oil, and ceruminous glands I mentioned last time, but just briefly. Cerumen, C-E-R-U-M-E-N, is the anatomical name for earwax. And so ceruminous glands are found only in the ear canal, which is part of the outer ear, that ends at the tympanic membrane or eardrum. And in the skin that lines that ear canal are the ceruminous glands producing wax. Cerumen, though, is more than just the wax that the glands produce. It's also a collection of debris and pieces of hair. So it's not just pure wax by the time it accumulates. I didn't mention mammary glands at all, but they are listed here, even though technically they're part of the reproductive system. Mammary glands are found in female mammae, M-A-M-M-A-E, which is the plural of mamma, which is the name for a breast. Both sexes have them, mammae, but only females have mammary glands in them. So the mammary gland is not as nearly as big as the breast of a woman. Most of that is fatty tissue. And unless the woman is lactating, those mammary glands will be very reduced in size. They grow a little bit when they start working, when she starts lactating. But still, the vast majority of the volume of the breast is fat, not gland. So really, that mammary glands will be discussed in 202 as part of the reproductive system. And 11, I think there's one of these on all of the systems chapters where we survey a system at a time. These also I don't read to you, but they're interesting to look at because we study each of these organ systems in isolation, like I said, I think the first day, as though they exist in isolation. But they don't. None of the systems can function on its own. They all interact with each other. And sometimes it's not exactly obvious what the connection is between one system and another. Each chapter ends with a slide like this that shows you the relationship of the current system with all the other organ systems. And so that's that chapter.